All right. What we have been doing is we've been looking at a very vast and exceedingly difficult subject, the subject of consciousness, a subject that is too vast for the time that we have. And in this talk, you'll realize that. It'll be a little bit longer talk, but at that, it'll be frustrating in that it won't have all the material everybody'd like to get into. Now, we've seen part of the reason why this is a difficult subject is because in our consciousness, we're subject to illusion. And that one of the big illusions is that we think we are completely conscious, which we are not. And we think we are in control of our awareness, which we are not. We even feel this way despite the fact that there's plenty of evidence that we're not in touch, or we really aren't what we think we are. Now we've looked at the fact that there are no limits to consciousness. And it seems that with work, we can do whatever we want to with consciousness. On the other hand, the Rosicrucian philosophy shows that through the evolutionary creation, we have been formed to awaken objectively to specific different kinds of consciousness. But even then, within these limitations, there is so much that we can't even conceive the magnitude of what's available to us. We become conscious of the states of being, the reality in which we're becoming. It is the subject and the source of our consciousness. Until now, we have participated in this process mostly by responsiveness. We have become what we have become by responding to what the divine beings that have formed us have made us to be. As we unfold our consciousness, we become co-creators, just like those who did the forming. In the course of this superficial study that we've gone through in this week, we have a lot of things have come up which it would be very interesting and value to pursue. Little hints have been given along the way, and I'm no doubt going to pursue them, but this is a good thing because I hope that it leads each of you to follow some of the hints in these things and find out for yourself. In fact, tonight will be, when we get to the material, which will take to most of the evening to even get there, when we get to the few examples, that's primarily why they're given, is for people to take the ideas and run with them. Now, the thing which would normally be expected to be done at this time in this series of lectures would be to study the spiritual exercises that are given to awaken consciousness. That would be especially apropos because the Rosicrucian philosophy has its exercises based on the principles that are behind the evolutionary creation. And so that they're made, they're ideal for working with the consciousness that we're supposed to unfold. And as we advance, there will be even more of that. So the exercises are microcosmic versions of cosmic processes to cosmic ends. And therefore, they're completely harmonious to the means and ends of evolutionary activity. However, when I thought that over, I thought that would be a subject that would be way too large for one small talk, and so maybe at another time we'll do a little series on those. Instead, we're going to try to do something a little more fitting. And it may be a little bit difficult for you because you've missed a whole week, and this is building toward an end that may be a little bit hard. I'll try to stay away from being too much into specific terms. Now we're going to look at, without exercises, how waking consciousness is accomplished in us at this time in the evolutionary creation. To do that, we're going to look at one sentence out of the Rosicrucian Cosmoconception. It's mentioned in the Cosmoconception late in the book, and it's repeated at various other times in the literature. The sentence goes something like this: all consciousness is a result of the struggle between the vital body and the desire body. That's the sentence. It's quite a remarkable sentence in its claim. All consciousness is a result of the struggle between the vital body and the desire body. All consciousness is a result of the struggle between the desire body and the vital body. Now, at first, this seems absurd. It seems fantastic and even preposterous that our consciousness should be the result of something like that. However, it is a very bold and unambiguous statement from a very reliable source, so it's worthy of our attention. And for the rest of the evening, we're going to give our attention to that one sentence. To begin with, we need to understand that this statement is made up of words that may need clarification. In fact, the whole context of the sentence may need clarification. The sentence that we've just read or repeated assumes that there's at least a modest familiarity with Rosicrucian philosophy or mysteries of any kind. So we'll have to clear a few of those things up. It's always that kind of problem that comes up when writing for or speaking for an audience that's familiar with the subject. There's a tendency for the writer or speaker to use specialized language. And there's great value in that because you can avoid having to use cumbersome language where you explain everything and reinvent the wheel every time you make a sentence. So it has those positives. Other positives are the fact that it is brief and that it is precise. One of the main negatives is that it's always dangerous to assume anything about anyone, even people who may have studied something for a very long time. Another danger is that language becomes automatic and it becomes taken for granted. And hence it has a world all of its own. Sometimes it becomes removed from the reality to which it points. Thus we have things like jargon, which we find that in all the specialized sciences in the university environment, for example. Another example that many people are probably familiar with is liturgy. People have repeated a liturgy so many times that it becomes automatic. And it lessens the consciousness and puts one into a state of habit where it should be waking the consciousness and raising it to a higher level. So this simple statement from the Cosmoconception actually does have a tacit abbreviation in it. Even though it is very direct and very unambiguous, it is not meant to be absolute. So a more valid, explicit version of the sentence would read something like this. At this time in our participation in the evolutionary creation, all consciousness is a result of the struggle between the vital body and the desire body. We can say that with relative certainty, because the same cosmic conception describes times in the very distant future when we will have exalted states of consciousness and we won't even have a vital body or a desire body, and we'll be bringing out other states of consciousness through other vehicles. So it has to be local in time. What remains beyond this slightly temporal modification is to understand actually what is being said in the statement. So to do that, we have to get beyond the technical language and to understand the reality to which it points, at least a little bit. Now, there are two specialized technical terms in this statement, which are vital body and desire body. Fortunately, we have developed a minimal understanding of these technical terms in the earlier talks, so it doesn't have to be a complete reinvention of the wheel. The mysteries philosophies, and in this case specifically the Rosicrucian philosophy, teaches that there are states of being on the spirit-matter pole within the one. And they are macrocosmic worlds, each of which has a different character, a different consciousness, and a different purpose. And each of them is a state of matter in the lower end that is to be spiritualized into new waking spiritual consciousness. Can't say completely new because it was there in some kind of a sleeping sense before. The vital body is comprised of the material from the etheric subdivision of the physical world, which means that the chemical subdivision that we see every day and are very familiar with, which is composed of solids, liquids, and gases, there are four higher states of physical existence, which are called ethers, which do various things like direct energy, promote life or actually facilitate life, transport sensory perceptions, do memory work, take memory impressions and things like that. So the vital body is a body that corresponds atom for atom with the physical body, only it is composed of life and energy and vitality. And the physical body is suspended in it. And since they are both of the physical realm, in the interactions, the physical body can grow and it can be vital, it can be alive, and it has the capacity for action and all of those things that we associate with vitality and energy. Through it, we grow, we have sense perceptions, and all of the things that we do in the dense physical body. Some of its functions are biological, taking care of the dense physical body, and some of them are soulful or spiritual, conveying things back and forth from the external worlds of perception back to the higher vehicles and to the spirit itself, and taking intuitive and creative impulses from the spirit and bringing them into the body where they can have a final completion in the dense physical body. The desire body is comprised of desire stuff, and the desire world is a completely different world from the physical world. It has its own laws. It has its own ways of functioning, and it has its own principles and purposes. Now, because it's a different world, if a person is clairvoyant, they may see it in three-dimensional space as occupying the same area as the dense physical body, but it's almost as though it is inwardly superimposed on the dense physical body because you're seeing a different world. And it is possible to see both worlds simultaneously. The aura, as it is described, the desire aura, not the etheric aura, but the desire aura is not an emanation from the dense physical body. It is a completely separate body. It is, the reason it's only an ovoid aura is because it's very early in its development. We get our vehicles of consciousness one after another over millions and millions of years of time, if the word years even can even use that. The desire body interpenetrates three-dimensional space and the stuff of the physical world. And even though it is a different world, by a kind of resonance, it can activate the etheric body to move the dense physical body, and it can be activated by thought forms, etheric thought forms in the etheric body that are resonantly picked up. By resonance, we mean something like tuning forks. If you have a desire body that you have created and a physical vital body complex that you have created, they have your tone of creativity. And when something is relevant in the desire body to things that are relevant in the physical etheric, there is a resonance so that one of them is attuned to the other. It's a very difficult, because it's not direct. It's not like you take and push this along with your finger. There is a resonant impingement of one thing on another. So the desire body is composed of the stuff of the desire world. It's a body that is made up of feeling, desire, motivation, emotions, passions, and it can be anything from a momentary emotion that lasts a fraction of a second to a lifelong mood. Everybody has a basic tone to their aura, and that tone is the mood that they have toward life. And as much as they are aware of desire, that bright is the desire body. It wouldn't be a matter of saying who's awake and who isn't to desire. If you had two clairvoyants and you had two people, one standing against the wall, you could see that one would have a much brighter aura than the other because that one was more aware of emotion, desire, and motivation. Now, we're speaking rather authoritatively here, and that has to be that way. The Rosicrucian philosophy very much recommends developing the soul power and developing the control of consciousness so you can see these things for yourself. The Rosicrucian philosophy promotes first-hand experience. And there's almost a anti-authoritarian attitude in it, like I have to see for myself. It encourages tests and trials. And even without being clairvoyant, we can perform tests and trials to understand the motivational nature. We can see it by the effects in the dense physical world. That's an important thing to do. I'd like to give some of those tests and trials, but it would take us way far away from what we need to accomplish tonight. The dense physical body, the vital body, the desire body, and the concrete mind, which is made of yet other substance, that is, of concrete thought substance, are vehicles of consciousness. Consciousness is in the spirit. So we have vehicles of consciousness, and we have consciousness. The spirit is the truth knower. The spirit is what is the source of consciousness. So in the process of having vehicles of consciousness, one becomes aware of states of matter, which we've been saying all along are congealments of the cosmic dream. They are also reflective projections of the ignorance of the universal spirit in the constant ongoing creative process. I don't want to, you know, I don't get too far out in explaining, or, you know, we've had a whole week of that. In this whole series, we've been talking about how potential waking self-consciousness is accomplished through the evolutionary creation. We have mentioned that in that process, states of matter, which represent unconscious or semi-conscious being within the one, and states of spirit are conscious states of being within the one. Now, in a creative manifestation, spirit gives itself to matter. In a process that is called the materialization of spirit, we've been calling it the projection of the dream, which is perfectly all right. And the materialization of spirit occurs in the realms or worlds that are more matter, like within the one. And as matter is awakened to spiritual potential by the interaction of spirit and matter, the essence of that experience, the essence of the potential of spiritual consciousness that lies in material worlds, is taken into the spirit and itself becomes spirit. It is an ever-becoming process. The result of the spiritualization of matter and the materialization of spirit, which takes place in worlds and in specific in vehicles of consciousness, the result of that is the evolution of consciousness. So this is all week we've been trying to get to consciousness. Now that brings us back to our sentence. All consciousness is a result of the struggle between the vital body and the desire body. Now we have roughly a picture of what that process of awakening consciousness is like, and we know what the vital body and the desire body are in rough. Now all we need to do is understand the hows and whys of the struggle. Each of the vehicles of consciousness has its own character. It is usually the same or analogous or a version of the character of the world of which it is an expression. We remember that our physical bodies are made out of the physical world. They are microcosmic workings in the physical world, just as trees and other vegetables or animals, their physical bodies are also microcosmic expressions of the physical world. The character of the world, or the character of the body, is a concrete attribute of the spirit of which it is a reflected projection. Woo! It's not pleasant. We've been saying that into potential, within the absolute, there is potential. There is becoming out of potential into actual. There is passing from a state of could-be consciousness into waking consciousness. And when the creative spirit, just like a painter, projects the dream into that potential, in that projection of itself into the potential is like a mirror image. And that mirror image congeals with that potential. And in the process of spirit interacting with that ignorance, with that unknown, that immobility of those worlds, is the way that new spirit is waked up. And it is realized by the spirit giving itself totally to that, so that itselfness for itself is completely given up for the other. And in that, the dream is realized, and it is no longer a dream. This is a process that all artists have to deal with. They have to realize that, you know, unless they can communicate to someone the reality that they're trying to experience or have them experience, what will happen is they'll be living in their own dream, and it won't be anything. Their projection won't be anything like what they're trying to communicate, and it certainly will not be realized, at least in the sense we are talking about. The deepest attribute of the spirit that we work with, which subsists transcendentally, it is the basic being, or the basic beingness. And that is the will to be. And that is what is reflected as the chemical region of the material world. It is stuff. Simplest state of external or existing matter or being. So this is the existent world that we see. That's the most basic. A thing is the most basic state of a being within being or beingness, would probably be a better word. It's hard to find words for things like this. The will to be of divine spirit is reflected into the inertial quality of dense physical matter. We all know about that. I didn't for a few times in life. And you know that twice I've walked into street poles, and once I walked into a Coke machine. I really wasn't in the dense physical world. The second attribute of the threefold spirit is called life spirit. And it is reflectively projected into the etheric region of the physical world. Life spirit is just what the word says. Everything that can be connoted by the word life, to be vividly alive in spirit. But the love wisdom that is in that life spirit is so big, and its purpose is so deep and so general, that we can only speak of it in trite truisms. We hear it all the time. Somebody will say something that is incomprehensibly deep in an everyday experience, and they say, that's life. That's a pretty trite statement, but that is. Now, the understanding of this is a very deep matter, because spiritual life, like divine spirit and life spirit, have no form. And life spirit has no conditioning of any kind. People talk about unconditional love. That's the nature of love. It is unconditioned, and it is unconditional. We can't really conceive of it with this kind of consciousness. Being such, it has been described as ineffable or void of definition by anyone who has ever experienced it. By analogy, using human words, it has often, in the Trinity of Spirit, that is reflected into matter, it is referred to as the preserver, or the redeemer, or the sacrificer, where the will of the divine spirit is carried out. It's the nurturer of life, but it does it through pure imagination, as we've said several times. Not an imagination that has imaginings, but an imagination that makes the makes imagination possible at all. It's very another one of those deep things that we don't have time to try to say out really clearly, but we've tried to give examples all week. It has also been seen as the divine emanation, the spiritual light that is an expression of the power of the first attribute. The vital body, which is its reflection, is the vehicle of vital life, energy. It gives life and vitality, and it preserves the physical body, allows it to grow, allows it to heal, cleans it, does all of those kinds of things, modifies it. So it is the caregiver. Like the second attribute of the spirit, it is a middle person. It is a middle person that conveys outward experiences in this dense physical world to the higher vehicles and eventually to the spirit itself. Or when there are emotions or thoughts or intuitions or creative impulses and they need to be fulfilled by being carried out into this external world, they are transported by the etheric vital body. The third attribute of manifest spirit is called human spirit. We've said all along it's not considered pure spirit because it is in the realm of ideational or abstract thought. And therefore, it has within it self-limitations. Self-limitations as any idea or concept has. We said that life spirit is pure truth. And truths, universal truths, are of human spirit. And we said that life spirit is the selfness, the altruistic love that all selves are made of, but the individual selves are of human spirit, so that one cannot have an experience of self without at the same time realizing that is what is in within oneself is the same as with what is within all other selves. A mystic should never have to practice altruism. It should be automatic. Because once you have experienced the truth of that, once you have gotten beyond self, you recognize that it is something that is common to all and you don't have to practice what happens as part of its nature. As we said in an earlier thought, it is the central idea in the region of abstract thought or the region of the human spirit. The centermost idea that is closest to the realm of concrete thought that we've already spoken of is the idea of self. Even our higher self, what we call our divine self, is an idea. But it's not an ordinary idea like one of ours. It is a divinely conceived idea. And it doesn't really become ours until we completely control, can unfold all of the divine potential within it, which means until we really are God. And the biggest inhibition to that is egoism of all things. I guess it's sort of self-evident in the whole business. This is where truth becomes truths, becomes universal ideas. Now the third attribute, this quasi-separative self, is known as the doer, the actor. In the Eastern Trinity, for example, Shiv is the spinner, sets everything in motion. It's even the destroyer because it destroys the unity by bringing something to even an abstract kind of completion. The most important act that it does is it thinks. And in thinking, it takes the potential within spirit, it compounds ideas, and it projects them into the world, into the concrete realms, to be carried out. It is the one that is the last member of spirit that is involved in the materialization of spirit. Now, in this kind of doing being, this actor has something to do. The character of this actor, of always having to be acting or doing something, has something to do with its incompleteness because it's not pure spirit. But that's a subject that I'd like to go into, but it's a little too far afield. I'm just putting these things out there as temptations. Everything wants to be whole. That is, we desire things because we want to be whole in them. And people who have the least amount of fulfillment in themselves have the greatest amount of desire, and those are greedy people. That's a little further down the alley with that hint or temptation. In reflection, the principle of the human spirit becomes the desire world and the desire body. As we said earlier, the desire body is the motivator. It is the driver of the physical etheric organism. In the same way that the life spirit becomes the spectrum of universal principles in the human spirit, the light of life spirit becomes spiritual color. The desire world is the world of emotional tone, emotional color. So that to have desire world clairvoyance is to see the desires of people as though they were colors. Colors being the exterior of them and the meaning of the motivation being their interior. In the same way that human spirit is an individuated self, the desire is the home of the pseudo-self, that lower ego or that false ego or pseudo-ego, which has sort of an ad hoc existence. So this gives us a little bit of an idea of how the attributes of the spirit are reflected in the attributes of the different bodies. Now, before we pass on, it should be mentioned for those who are interested that the concrete mind, the very heart of the concrete mind, where spirit and matter meet, or where the transcendental and phenomenal meet, is the reflecting and projecting agency. Everything concrete, including all of the vehicles of concrete existence, have their beginning and their end in the center of concrete thought, which itself is superimposed on, the spot that never was, but that is the center of our entire being, our entire virgin spirit, that all of this takes place around. All right. The transcendent reflections and the foci of the spirit into matter, we have just mentioned, revolve around this center. This center is where everything is that is important. Now, the mind is extremely flexible and adaptable, so that even though divine spirit at this time is reflectively projected into dense physical matter, and the life spirit is projected into the ethers, that mind is a variable focus lens, so that at different phases in the evolution it will focus the realms of spirit into different manifest phenomenal worlds as the whole cosmos collapses back into itself. And so that so that what we're talking about now is not going to remain constant in a cosmological sense. Now for the reflective focus. It is that way for now. It is the basic way that everything is accomplished. The externalization, the internalization, the reflection on it. We mentioned in past talks that states of universal spirit are pure spirit. You can't even call them God because they are spirit, and they spirit. And the only way they know a selfhood is through a reflection off the mind. That being becomes a being, and that self-consciousness is reflected back onto states of spirit in the process of that kind of creative thinking in reflection. So we can see that there is a significant difference in character for each of the vehicles of consciousness and each of the worlds in which those vehicles of consciousness exist. All of these vehicles of consciousness, when in the direct service and under the control of the one unified spirit, work together. But we know we're not self-conscious yet. We're not completely in control. Our self-consciousness is very limited, and so is our creative control. We're far from being awake in any of the attributes of the spirit. This might be a shock to a lot of people, but as super conscious as spirit is, that seems to know everything, even though we only hear whispers of it, and we're very fortunate if we have even one of those whispers. It may sound blasphemous, but the spirit is really very little awake. It's a little island of waking self-consciousness, even in spirit, that we have. And the spirit is especially unawake with regard to its concrete vehicles. We're getting to where we want to get to. It is especially far from being completely indrawn and directly radiant through its vehicles, and doesn't always have control of them, especially the desire body. So in recognition of this, we find St. Paul saying, "The good that I would, I do not." There are things in spirit that we'd like to do, but we don't seem to be able to bring them through. This means that given the slack, these vehicles will act autonomously according to the character of the nature that they are composed of the world they are composed of, and what we have given to them in terms of character. This is especially with regard to the desire body where that pseudo-self exists. So when the spirit isn't completely in control, it takes over. And then we have the other half of the statement by St. Paul. That which I would not, that do I. Meaning to say that there's a part of us that commits things that we would never want to commit if we were completely awake in it. And so this brings us exactly to the struggle between the vital body and the desire body, each having its own specific character. We're going along nicely. It isn't going to be any longer than 3 hours and 10 minutes. Before we can go very far, we have to make another little excursus here. We have to differentiate between autonomy and what could be called autopilot. It would be a great waste for the spirit to put its full direct attention to everything that is done in its vehicles. It's the same thing that an architect may be a brilliant architect and may understand everything, but it's the construction workers that carry out the design because, you know, you would want an architect being the stonemason or doing the plumbing or something like that. It would be a waste of that kind of attention. And so there is a certain amount of automatic pilot in the character of each of our vehicles, so that the spirit can give it an impulse and that vehicle will carry that out. To some extent, things that we do with deliberate waking consciousness, even some that seem trivial, are one of the best ways to unfold clairvoyance. That if you do everything that you do in your waking consciousness with full deliberate self-consciousness, like if I move my hand like this, I know that I am doing it and why I am taking that form of it. If you do that kind of deliberate self-consciousness, that's one of the best ways to wake up to yourself as the doer and to wake up a clairvoyance that you can see into everything you're doing, because it's like you're really applying the will to doing even the most trivial things. Of course, you can't do that with everything that is within the sphere of the self. For example, in all of the millions of things that are happening in our physiology, we can't self-consciously do all of them right now, maybe, but not all of that right now. So, if left alone to itself, the vital body would be in autopilot, and it would go into a vegetative state. It would grow, it would metabolize, it would take food in, it might even take in sensory perception, and it would do all of these things, and it would tend to all of these things under the control of the spirit. It would be completely peaceful. It would be vegetative. It would be like a plant. This happens in some cases of what we call insanity. The spirit can't get all the way through. And in some cases, it depends on where the break in the line of consciousness occurs. But if the vital body and the physical body are left relatively alone because there's a break and only some of the wires, so to speak, get through to the physical, then you have somebody that just wants to sit there and stare and vegetate. Each of the kinds of insanity is describing the state of something that's in a severe state of disrepair in our inner psychological nature, but we don't have time to go into that. On the other hand, if the desire body had uncontrolled autonomy, which it almost does most of the time, it would have the physical etheric body constantly acting, constantly carrying out exciting desires and clogging the physical body with foods that were exciting, and until it was exhausted and broken down, as when we go to sleep. Sounds like life, doesn't it? So you can see that in the seesaw, the libration back and forth, in the struggle between the vital body and the desire body, the upper hand right now seems to be in the be with the desire body. It happens every day, and the desire body has to leave because there's nothing you can do anymore. And then the vital body has its perfect state. When we wake up in the morning, we're refreshed because the vital body all night has been doing its vegetative work, and it works a miracle for us. Now, I don't want to make this sound too much like the desire body is a baddie here. If I do that, just yell or something like that. Say, I'm for the desire body, and you're being unfair to my side. The thing about this is that both vehicles are struggling for autonomous control of the dense physical body, and that the result of that is waking consciousness. This is because the dense physical body is the only vehicle of consciousness that is sufficiently ripe. It's been brought to perfect ripeness through four stages of development. It has been brought to the human-like state at which it is ready for waking consciousness. It's the only one. And right now, in general, throughout all of creation, it is the vehicle for waking consciousness. Now, we mentioned earlier in this talk, and we've mentioned it in other talks, that the interaction of spirit and matter, the result of that, when the essence is taken out of matter, and matter, so to speak, is in a way dissolved, the result of that is what is called soul. This is a very specific term in Western spiritual philosophy. Soul is the essential essence of a state of matter that has become spiritualized sufficiently to be extracted and to be taken into the waking consciousness of spirit for the becoming of spirit. So that is what, I won't repeat that because it's too hard for me to repeat, and I'm dumb and dead and tired by now. So, soul material is taken out and absorbed, and it is assimilated in the spirit. This is what the process of the spiritualization of matter is all about. It's taken out of that ignorant, unconscious state, that state of potential, and it is brought into spiritual completeness or finality, or as much as finality is as there is in something ongoing. We actually reap soul material from each of our vehicles of consciousness. And through the mind, through that lens of mind, they are taken into becoming spirit. They are assimilated to their corresponding spiritual attribute. Some people have been talking in the last day about the experience they had at Eddie's house with flying squirrels being inside and being, and everybody, even when Eddie just remembered the experience, everybody remembered the experience, and that remembrance, or that rethinking remembrance, is how the essence of that interaction was taken into spirit. And that will result in future consciousness. Emotional soul is what we get out of spiritualizing desire experience. The more different kind of emotions we can feel, and right now our emotional nature, even in very rarefied people, is not very well developed. But people who have gone through all kinds of feelings and the spirit has groaned through them all, even the pleasant ones, it becomes emotional soul. So that you can tell an emotional person that they have something, that they know the nature of motivation. They know where an emotional train is going, because that has been awakened in spirit, and some of that desire matter has been spiritualized into the spirit so that there is more consciousness of that also. The material that is taken out of the etheric body, the vital body, is called intellectual soul, because the intellect is the name for the life spirit. Which, like in for Bob, the word for life spirit is the void or the Buddhic consciousness. The ancient Greeks called the life spirit intellect. So intellectual soul comes out of the etheric vital body, and it is absorbed and assimilated to the life spirit. And thus, as much as we understand what is pro-vitality, and what is pro-energy, it results in a positivity. Whereas those things that are deathly result in a soulful awareness of something that is antipathetic to ongoing life. And so there is a great sympathy and antipathy awareness in a person who has a lot of intellectual soul. We can assimilate more intellectual soul than we can emotional soul, but not as much as conscious soul. Conscious soul is the basic consciousness, the will to be, the knowing that we are that comes from the interaction with matter. And since the world of dense physical matter, the chemical region of the physical world, since that is a realm of gravitation and a momentum and things like that, it is impact. So someone who has a lot of conscious soul is someone that, in the first place, is basically awake to being as it is, in no other way. The way it is the way it is. Moreover, someone with a lot of conscious soul knows the essence of matter and is capable of bringing more out of matter than a person who does not have a conscious soul. Like Rod, for example, when he was giving his talk the other day, he was talking about being able to develop materials that had never, ever been developed before. Rod was actually a major science story twice in the New York Times in the science column for two different kinds of materials that he produced that no one else had ever produced. So Rod is somebody that has a feel for matter. He is someone that has a lot of conscious soul. And to hear him talk, you know right away that he's conscious of what's going on. So this is what we're talking about with consciousness. This is what the whole week has been for. So the dense body, the dense physical body, is in its fourth stage of development, and it's especially ripe for bringing through conscious soul. And this is our ABC world, because here the limits are such that, you know, when I walked into that lamppost, there was no doubt about the density of that metal. It was an objective fact. And that objective fact, that kind of objectivity, is what we learn while this dense physical body is here, while this dense physical world is here. And it isn't going to be here forever, because even with the concentration of the universal spirit, the cosmos cannot be held this dense for an extremely long period of time. So they say, make hay while the sun shines. And it is our best and most valuable thing that we can do is to become more conscious and awake and develop more conscious soul and help others to do so, because all of our future objectivity depends on it. No matter how simple the object is, whether it's a kid playing marbles with a little spherical marble and knowing that a heavier marble is going to knock more out of the ring than a lighter marble. Those are things that are really, really important. Now, it's possible to wake up in our other bodies, but when we wake up, it's a marvelous experience because there's so much facility in them, but we can't wake up to the degree that we can wake up in the dense physical body, because they are not matured yet. They're not ready. It's because we need certain things very much that we learn to leave our body and to bring things through. But our most important work is here in the dense physical body. The future of consciousness is here. Because we remember that after a while, this physical plane isn't going to be here, and dense physical bodies aren't going to be here. So the degree that we have learned to use the dense physical body, it gets superimposed on the higher bodies. And so the basic consciousness of all the bodies, or in all of the bodies, depends on the basic consciousness that we have here in the dense physical. Really important thing. All right, let's example a little bit how the struggle between the vital body and the desire body works, so that we can understand the process of consciousness and work along with it. Let's examine consciousness a little bit more. We've been trying very carefully to differentiate between vehicles of consciousness and consciousness itself. The former, the vehicles of consciousness, are the various bodies, and they are in the worlds of matter, and the latter, the spirit, or the consciousness, is in the spirit itself. That's an example we mentioned before. But suppose you go out and get sunburned, or suppose you cut yourself. Now, the experience of that cut will be recorded by the nervous system, and it will be carried to the brain. And from the brain, it'll pass into the etheric brain. And from the etheric brain, it'll be impressed on the desire body. And the feeling will be in the region of feeling in the desire body, because that is where feeling comes to ripeness. But the consciousness will be in the human spirit, because the human spirit is the reflection of the desire body, and it is the work of the spirit to be conscious. So this is happening. It happens instantaneously. The slowest thing in the process is the neural transmission through the nerves, but it is actually that the consciousness is taking place in the spirit. Therefore, the more the spirit can be brought into the body, the more total all of our consciousness can be. And if we're doing creative work to help the mineral, the life that is now in the minerals, if we're doing that kind of creative work, if we can emanate and be right within the physical body instead of the awkward way that we're in it now, and we work by the sweat of our brow rather than by the consciousness of the spirit being materialized directly into matter in creative activities, the better it is for that whole thing. So there's unselfish motivation. We can have unselfish motivation and develop all of the qualities of the spirit, all of the powers of the spirit, without having to do it selfishly. We can do it for the sake of the all, for the minerals, or for the universal spirit itself. So we can see that there is a transcendental spiritual activity that parallels all of the somatic activity in the various concrete vehicles. So the struggle between the vital body and the desire body is for the function and the use of the dense physical body, which is the best vehicle and the only vehicle through which we can have complete waking consciousness at this time. The dense body and its use is the prize. Both the vital body and the desire body, in their own independent natures, when they're working on autopilot, want the physical body. It's something like everything in the cosmos wants completion. And completion is what is represented by the concrete state. In reflection, this means that the divine spirit is the most simple, but it's the most profound kind of consciousness that we have. It's like saying that this is the height of the Godhead. It is the purpose of all conscious activity. And that's just what we expect. Everything, this is why some people are materialistic. It isn't only greed in the desire body. People realize that the dense physical world and the dense physical body is a reflection of the deepest part of the spirit. And therefore, they want more of that deepest power of the spirit. That's where their security is in, but they're going for the reflection rather than for the spiritual reality. So this explains all kinds of different things. And finally, we're at that last page of notes, and this is where I start to get desperate, because we're only at the beginning of what I'd like to talk about. And this is only going to be a tease, because what we're going into now are the details. And there are many details in all of this that pertain to our lives. And this is where the creativity of living comes in. We have talked about, we realize the dream for the universal spirit when we live our lives creatively. We evict the gods that have made our bodies what they are now. We evict them by taking the principles that they have left in us and making them our own. It's like we learn something from somebody. Like if we're playing guitar, we get an influence from another musician. But we can't be that musician. You know, Ray Charles tried to be an exact duplicate of Nat King Cole, and it didn't work. Nobody was buying it. So, but when he had that influence in him, he began to realize himself. And when he threw out the influence of Nat King Cole, it was Ray Charles that was coming out. And the same thing is that if we live creatively and take these simple ideas and work them out on our own, it is something very important. All right, I'm going to give you two major examples with a few little sub-examples and hope that they are something that lead to better living and creative living and such like that. Now, the struggle between the vital body and the desire body has been going on for a long, long time. And it goes back and forth. Sometimes the desire principle is in supremacy, and sometimes the vital principle is in supremacy. It's like everything else in the evolution. It's a spiral, and there are spirals within spirals and spirals within spirals. And so some of the things are momentary, some of the things are daily, and some of them are eons long. Now, there's one very good example that is given in the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception. The effect, as a statement of fact, the effect of desire is hardening. It can be spiritual hardening or it can be physical hardening. Show me a person who is self-indulgent in desire and I will show you a person who is psychologically hard. Even if we indulge ourselves in the desire of doing something good, in the pleasing of ourselves, we harden. And the more we live in desire, the more hardened we are. Now, that isn't necessarily bad. If we're trying to be loving, if we're trying to be compassionate, if we're trying to do things for the world, it's very difficult. But we didn't, you know, as we came into this world, we didn't have always a hard endoskeleton. And in a long cosmic epoch, during the time when the desire was supreme is when we precipitated the hard skeleton. And the way this works out is exceedingly beautiful because Capricorn, in sign and in constellation, rules the skeleton. And it also rules the macrocosmic desire world. So you can see all of these things are very much tied together. The soft, the fluidic tissue of the body is ruled by the vital body. Whenever the vital principle is strong, things become softened. So the blood, which nourishes the whole body, is ruled by the vital principle, and it does the softening. In fact, if you do hardening things, like take alcohol or something like that, it begins to congeal. And the reason that people get dementia from alcohol is that it congeals so much that it produces long molecules that can't get through the little capillaries in the brain, and then brain cells are starved as a consequence, and they're asphyxiated. Not asphyxiated, what's the word? Suffocated. So there is this constant back and forth, which every principle that can be used or that is an impediment to us, if we understand that it is impedimental to us, if we understand that we're hard and we cannot be compassionate to the people that need our help, we know that we have to work more on the vital principle. Now, all of the main systems and all of the main activities in our dense physical body, whether we're consciously aware of them or not, they are all based on conscious interactions between the various attributes of the spirit. The blood by reflection is ruled by the life spirit. But the red blood, which does all of this work, all of this nurturing, all of this feeding, all of this taking away of the waste, is produced in the heart of the bones, in the marrow of the bones, and where the bones are ruled by the divine spirit. It's like the most mineral part of the dense mineral body. So if you find somebody that has a severe anemia or somebody that has a condition that they can't produce red blood, you can see that in the spirit that there is an interaction that is taking place between the life spirit and the divine spirit. That same is reflected between the dense physical body and the vital body. Everything is like that. I'm going to cut out a large amount here because this is way too long already. But you can see, like for example, the muscles are ruled by the desire principle. And so the desire principle, the muscles are stimulated by the nerves. So the relationship between the human spirit and the desire principle is involved in all muscular activity. So if you find somebody that has muscular dystrophy, you find somebody that's working with the spiritual principle of selfhood in the thinker, in the neural process, and the process of using desire to reach out for things or to bring things in or something like that. You, by taking each of the vehicles and each of the attributes of the spirit, you can see that this principle that is applied to all consciousness being a result of the struggle between the vital body and the desire body has very great meaning to it, or it has great implications. All right, let's do a little review, a three-step review. We're building consciousness by building conscious soul. And we are waking that consciousness, even if we're just metabolizing. The spirit is becoming in the process. If we want to know the nature and the function of the different attributes of the spirit and the higher vehicles of consciousness, we can learn this by studying physiology, by studying pathology, and all of those kinds of things. Because our body is our creation. As much as we can bring through in one rebirth, our physical body is the sum total of our consciousness. So you can see that the spirit, if somebody is basically unaware of their physical body, that's a tough situation. And that they're being brought to become aware of their body. I'll give you some examples. I'll give you two opposite examples. None of this is in the notes, so I'm just going crazy at the end there. I had a friend whose mother was brilliant, and she was an accountant for a large firm in the city here, and she was always in her head, and she was always very active. She was a thyroid type of personality, a very mercurial kind of activity, and she was very, very brilliant, but she carried that too far, and she got a stroke, and she lost all of that brilliance, but yet she had self-consciousness. And she sat there, and they would take her out in nature, and she said, "These are some of the happiest days of my life." She wasn't just in her head. She wasn't just in her mind. That had been denied to her, and she had to just appreciate the physical world. And she learned the lesson. She had about 3 or 4 years that way, and she was very contented, very happy. Some people, I've worked now with several people who have ALS, which is just the opposite condition. Some people are very much into the physical world, but they don't go into the inner worlds, especially they don't think and they don't bring the spirit to bear on it. And so what happens is the physical is left away and all they are is in their mind. And that's actually a more pitiful case because they have never learned how to use their mind, and it's really hard to coax them to do so. And they become more and more morose, and they become more and more depressed and are not that much in the mind. And, you know, they can't do with the mind what they're forced to do with it. Third thing, our balance and the efficient use of our desire body and vital body is reflected in the state of our health, in our dense physical body. If we are not peaceful and too driven by desire, we are not unfolding our consciousness as we are capable of. If we don't take care of the metabolic processes, if we go to the other extreme and are too much in the vital body, which I tend to do these days, I tend to take care of myself too much, a kind of lethargy or a laziness sets in, and so that we can't accomplish enough because we don't take initiative. We only get a small amount of time here, and we spend many, many years in between lives planning so that when we get here, that the few 70, 80, 90 years that we're here, that that little bit of time relative to the hundreds of years of preparation, that when we're here, it's gone. It's like you write a piece of music and it takes you 10 hours or something to write a piece of music and you play and it's over in 20 seconds. That's what our life here is like here. So if we don't have initiative, that's as bad as if we have too much initiative. The whole idea that I'm trying to get to is to recognize in our personal existence, especially with regard to our physical body and what we do in our physical body, to recognize what is an impulse from the vital body to take care of the physical body, or to be peacefully observant in the physical body, and what is desire. If we know what is desire, and you know, with age we certainly know that, we begin to see what is fruitful and what isn't, we begin to see, that's desire, that's not a spiritual impulse. And sometimes it's rather subtle. You know, the lower nature that functions in a desire body is pretty good at imitation. It can imitate something as though it came from the spirit itself when it really didn't. Anything to maintain its supremacy. Now, the battle between the desire body and the vital body, and between the human spirit and the life spirit, cannot be won. If it would be won, there would be a break in the fundamental structure of our entire being. What is looked for is cooperation. It's a beneficial struggle. It's not a thing, a fight to the finish or something like that. The desire body sometimes thinks that way. So the Rosicrucian philosophy finds that it's almost like the three Grey Sisters in Greek mythology. They were wise women that had only one eye between them, and they would pass the eye back and forth so that they could see, and they were very wise. That religions that are given to humanity, especially in one very large cycle, are part of this whole struggle. St. Paul tells us, for example, at one time there was a people of Melchizedek, and it was the people of Enoch, as in the book of Enoch. We were all one universal brotherhood, or one universal humanhood would probably be better. It's a less discriminating term. And that we were peaceful and loving. But it was our destiny to become individuals and to become self-conscious. So that religion at that time was a religion of the life spirit. From there, things have shifted to the religion of the human spirit, to the religion of Jehovah. And the end of Jehovah is to produce individuals, because it is the individuals that bring all of the unique self-consciousness to the general self-consciousness of the universal spirit. You have to be an individual before that happens. The problem of dealing with self is done very well in esoteric Christianity. But at any rate, humanity was broken into races, into cultures, into tribes, and they were all parallel. And we were guided by nationality spirits or cultural spirits or race spirits or clan spirits, always breaking down until we became individuals. And that was under the charge of the human spirit. But it's like in a relay race. The time when the baton is being passed is the most critical moment. And there is always a back and forth between the human spirit and the life spirit. So there is also, in a similar way, a struggle now between the human spirit as we become self-conscious and the life spirit as we aspire to live for the universal other. In Christianity, we call that living for the Christ. And our self is realized in the selfness of the Christ. And so all of our consciousness, as it is developed at this time, it is developed between the human spirit and the life spirit, between the self and the other, and this is how we come to awakeness. We can't know anything about the world without knowing about self. And we can't really know about self without knowing selfness, or without knowing the infinite or spiritual other, that is the other of all. And so this is part of this. All consciousness, in this case, is a struggle between the life spirit and the human spirit. Only in this case, for us, we're probably over-individuated and we carry it into personality, and what we need to do is more think in terms of the other, but that's always a struggle. As the Aquarian Age has been coming on, this has been coming more and more. Now I'm going to talk about something that is one factor in life. Life itself is very complicated. But this is a very subtle, important factor in life. As the Aquarian Age has come on, what happened at the last conjunction of the planets that represent the right and the left? Pluto conjoined Uranus, and at that time, Das Kapital was written by Karl Marx. It is the first time in history of self-conscious political trying to work together that the whole was thought about. It turned out to be very materialistic. It was communistic. When the Uranus half of the cycle took over, then we had the formation of all of the communist states, starting with the Bolshevik Revolution, which began right at that opposition of Uranus and Pluto. The whole idea is that this is a cycle, and there are sub-cycles that go the same within it, that there is a cycle where the emphasis is either on collective rights, which is of the life spirit, or on individual rights, which is of the human spirit. And so this takes place all the time. But because we humans are not perfect, what happens is, a perfect example was Yugoslavia. The communist collective outlook held all these separative nationalistic people together under one monolithic totalitarianism, because it wasn't done in freedom, because all of the individuals were not individuated enough so that they could give themselves to the whole. And as soon as the cycle turned over again, then communism disappeared, and we had a very volatile situation in Yugoslavia. You can see it right here in the United States, but let's look at it in the lower level of it. When the lower level of the life spirit is the vital body, and the vital body wants to vegetate. What happened in the Soviet Union, where there was a totalitarian trial at a communism or at a life spirit state, is people became very complacent, and they became they lost initiative. On the other hand, now we're in the cycle where individual rights, unfortunately people think that a corporation is just another individual, instead of seeing it as a soulless entity, which is what it really is, But now the desire body is supreme. And what happens? Greed is running rampant. People, you know, I don't want to be political about this, but in the Bush years, and he represents the height of swinging to the right, with all the tax cuts, it is just as they predicted. There is more poverty. Unfortunately, you can't go deeper into poverty. You can go until you have nothing, and then you're there. The upper middle class gained wealth at 5%, but the rich, the wealth of the rich has increased by 65%, and this is by the government that brought us this. But you see, this is something, you know, I had to live with it all of my life. I used to fashion myself as something of a leftist kind of person. And then I lived behind the Colosseum over here. I had a lovely big garden and all of that. But unfortunately, when I wanted to go somewhere, if there was a rock concert or if there was a hockey game or something, I couldn't get through. I'd have to go way out of my way to Fitchburg to get to downtown. And sometimes when you sit in a traffic jam like that and wait, the still small voice says to you, how much do you believe in the good of the collective rights? Here you are, you're selfish and angry, and you're really not living up to what you think you are. So these are all kinds of little things. When we can recognize the desire principle overcoming the vital principle, or the vital principle overcoming the desire principle in our lives, that's when we're out of whack. That's when we are not efficient. This is a struggle to the good. We want to be efficient in waking consciousness. We want the vehicles to work together. And we're saying that we are human beings that are capable of self-conscious control. We can direct our awareness, and we can unfold as we need to unfold. Now, these are just the beginnings. Only the last few years I've been thinking on these things, but there are tons and tons of other things that could be brought out of this. It's that one sentence, the more I look into it, the more I find it's richer and richer. It's one of those things that leads us to what Goethe said as his last words when he was leaving the body, light, more light. So we'll turn the light off at that, and we'll all say the Rosicrucian student's prayer together. O God, increase our love for thee, so that we may serve thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Thank you very much. It's a fun time.